everyone. It's Scott Tips again, and it is March 6th, 2013, and I hope you're all well. I just want to let you know that I don't have any particular guests today. I had Mr. Ian Crane on last time. We had such a good turnout on the chat line. I was very thrilled, and I thought Ian, as usual, did a fantastic job. And I want to remind all of you that he's making a tour, Ian is, of the UK and speaking on fracking and the dangers and some other things, quite honestly, as well. But I think fracking is his latest issue. And I want to encourage you to go to his website to see where he's speaking. He just spoke last Friday in Glastonbury, but I don't know where he is this week or next week or what his schedule is. But if you go to his website, which I think is enrcrane.co.uk, I think you can pretty much find what you want. Now, this is really all off the cuff tonight. I mean, totally a hodgepodge of different things. So I want to give out something I don't always do, but a call-in number at TNS Radio here. And this is a number, if you have a pen ready or your keypad ready to note this down, I'll give you the phone number. And if you have a question to ask me or a particular topic you want to discuss with me and you promise not to hog the mic, then give a call. Or maybe you should promise to hog the mic. I don't know. Depends upon how good you are. But anyway, if you're in Europe, of course, or Australia or whatever, you call this Irish country code number. So 00353 is the country code, then 144-3309. So let me say it in more English speak, Brit speak, 00353144-3309. And if you're in Canada or the U.S., then instead of 00 at the beginning, you would do 001 and then call in. So just call in and we'll just go ahead and get started now. The thing I want to tell you is in about a week, I'll be leaving for the Codex Alimentarius meeting in Beijing, China. I'll be leaving from the west coast of the U.S., and the National Health Federation will be attending. There are a couple of issues there, and this is the Chinese committee. Well, it's the Codex Committee, but it's hosted by the Chinese government, the Codex Committee on Food Additives, and NHF has gone there since 2008, not often because it's an expensive trip. And thank you to all of you who have donated to make that possible, by the way. Go to our website, www.thenhf.com, and please make a donation if you haven't already. We really rely on that. We don't have deep, big pharma pockets. We don't have, you know, a nice, rich uncle in our background to give us money, and it certainly doesn't include Uncle Sam, whom we're usually up against at these meetings. But we are going to this particular meeting, NHF is, and I'll be making arguments against aluminum food-containing additives and food additives involving aspartame. Now, interestingly enough, the European Union is very now, conveniently, a little bit late, but to the game, but still there, still showing up. The European Union has taken a very firm anti-aluminium, as you would say, food additive stance, and they specifically asked for NHF to be there to support them because evidently it's the EU and NHF against the world on this issue. The chairman at the 2008 meeting, I remember him very clearly before the EU changed its mind on aluminum. And the chairman and NHF were the only ones against aluminum in food additives, or aluminum-containing food additives, I should say. So it'll be interesting to see what happens if we make more progress And I think we actually will. But this is a huge issue because a lot of substitutes are out there and they exist. I mean, it's possible. We don't have to throw aluminum, which is very toxic, very cumulative, and as you know, has been implicated with everything from Alzheimer's to kidney failure to many things. And if you follow the chemtrail story, you know they're dumping it in the sky by bucket loads to try to take care of global warming, you know, that big urban myth that's been going around for way too long. And so this is something that's quite serious. And then on top of it, we will be arguing all by our little lonesome on the aspartame, or in this case, neotame issue. And that is that's another hot issue. But unfortunately, we won't have the EU on our side there, so it'll be NHF against the world. But that meeting starts, well, in about 8 days' time. And it starts with an electronic working group that has now been transmogrified into a physical working group. And if you know how the Codex process works, in between the regular committee meetings, sometimes to make progress at a faster rate, the chairman or chairwoman of the committee will appoint a country to be head of what's known as an EWG, an electronic working group. Now, the electronic working group can kind of, as I was saying, transmogrify itself into a physical working group just prior to a Codex meeting. And that means that this EWG then sits down in a room and hashes things out. And then the chairwoman or chairman will write up a report and submit it to the committee. And if you don't go to the working group, sometimes you're really foreclosed from making a difference on these things. It's really funny because in the same way I've told all of you in the past about how, you know, how the commission just sort of rubber stamps what the committees do. You know, you have this, it's a long story made short. You have an 8-step process to get a standard approved. And when it reaches the 8th step, then it's finally adopted by the committee, but then it has to pass it up to the commission. Well, the commission gets these a dime a dozen. There can be literally hundreds of these to be approved. And at every commission meeting I've been to, it's like a rubber stamp. The chairman will be up there and he'll say, okay, the standard for beef burgundy stew is any objections? No. Okay, passed. Okay, the standard for water and medicinal whatever. Okay, no objections, approved. Boom. It's really an even faster than that because they get a rhythm to them. And back in 2005, in July 2005, I had to actually break the rhythm because I was the only person to really speak up against the adoption of the vitamin and mineral food supplement standards at that time. You may recall the big battle in the first half of the 2000s. And NHF in South Africa, well, we were the only ones in town opposing these, you know, putting maximum upper limits on really harmless vitamin minerals, actually very healthful vitamin and mineral supplements. So that is really how it works there. Well, the story is that then the committee, in the same way that the commission relies on what the committee does, the committees rely on what the working groups do. And they will, depending on the committee, they will actually sometimes foreclose you at the actual plenary session, as they call it, the meeting, from speaking out if you weren't at the physical working group, and speaking out at that time. So it's very important for me to be there at the working group that's going to be meeting Thursday and Friday before the regular session of this food additives committee. So there you have it. Long story made short. And I'll be giving you a report from the meeting. And on that Wednesday, whatever that Wednesday is, let me look at the calendar. That is March 20th. I will be doing a session. I think I will. I haven't done the time zone difference calculation yet, but I'll be doing a TNS radio session, my regular event from there, from Beijing. So stay tuned for that. Next week I'll be in transit. I'll be flying. So what I'm going to do is, treat you guys to the interview that was done of me by Alex Gerrans on Red Alert Radio. And Vin is going to fix it up where that airs. And, so stay tuned. It was actually if I do say so myself, a fairly interesting, interview. And I think you'll like it. It was, believe it or not, on gun control and some other issues that Alex had in mind, Alex and his sidekick, Valentine. So anyway, if you have any questions on the chat line, please put them in all caps, or at least the word question in all caps so I see it. I'm not really going to be looking at the chat line much, so it needs to really stand out. And so we will just proceed. What do I have to tell you? Okay. Well, something that I've wanted to say before. So I don't know if you know why, and this is going to come completely out of the blue, but I just find it kind of funny, why the U.S. standard railroad gauge, and you'll laugh, is 4 feet, 8.5 inches. Does anyone know that? You know, that's a really odd number. So why was that gauge used? Well, they did that in the U.S. because that's the way they built them in England. And English expatriates designed the U.S. railroad. So why did the English build them like that? Well, because the first rail lines were built by the same people who built the pre-railroad tramways, and that's the gauge they used. But why did they use that gauge then? Well, again, because the people who built the tramways used the same jigs and tools that they'd use for building wagons, which used that wheel spacing. Why did the wagons have that particular odd wheel spacing? Well, if they tried to use any other spacing, the wagon wheels would break on some of the old long-distance roads in England because that was the spacing of the wheel ruts in the roads. Well, who built those old rutted roads? You guessed it, Imperial Rome built those old rutted roads. They built the first long-distance roads in Europe, including England, for their legions so they could march to battle on those very quickly and quell any rebellions. And those roads have been used ever since, certainly in England. And the ruts in the roads, well, those came from Roman war chariots, which formed the initial ruts, which everyone else had to match for fear of destroying their wagon wheels. Since the chariots were made for Imperial Rome, they were all alike in the matter of wheel spacing. Therefore, the U.S. standard railroad gauge of 4 feet, 8.5 inches is derived from, you guessed it, the original specifications for an Imperial Roman war chariot. In other words, bureaucracies live forever. So the next time you're handed a specification, procedure, or process and wonder what horse's ass came up with this, you may be exactly right, because Imperial Roman army chariots were made just wide enough to accommodate the rear ends of two war horses. So we aren't kidding when we say these were designed for horses' asses. In fact, when you see a space shuttle sitting on its launch pad, of course, they stopped using the U.S., stopped using the space shuttle, but when you used to see it there, you would notice there were two big booster rockets attached to the sides of the main fuel tank. Those were solid fuel rocket boosters, and they were made by a factory in Utah in the United States. Well, the engineers who designed these boosters wanted to make them a bit bigger, but they had to be shipped by train from the factory to the launch site, and the railroad line from the factory happens to run through a tunnel in the mountains, and the boosters had to fit through that tunnel. The tunnel is slightly wider than the railroad track, and the railroad track, as you now know, is about as wide as two horses' behinds. So a major space shuttle design feature of what is arguably the world's most advanced transportation system was determined over 2,000 years ago by the width of a horse's ass. And I bet you thought horses' asses weren't important. Well, now you know, horses' asses control everything. And next time you ride on the rails in Ireland or in Canada or in the UK or the US, then you will know you're just riding on something that was designed to accommodate two horses' rear ends. So in any event, I, in case she loses it, good call. Okay. Just looking to see who said anything. And, hey, someone said it was from pre-Roman Celtic chariots. Well, okay. There's a good debate. We can dig back even deeper and see where the Roman war chariots came from and see what was involved there. So I actually was dying to say that last time, but it just didn't quite seem appropriate when Ian was going on and we already had gotten on so late. Now, in the U.S., you may have heard about, well, throughout the world, actually, you may have heard about the so-called balanced budget amendment that some people are pressing or pushing for in the U.S. to pass as an amendment to the U.S. Constitution. And there are, unfortunately, a lot of people jumping on board. Well, you know, it really sounds like a great idea, this balanced budget amendment. But the problem with it is a little bit of history here. Back before the U.S. Constitution was adopted and put into effect in 1787 was that the Articles of Confederation controlled the United States, and it required or called for a more sort of decentralized U.S. with a very weak central government. I preferred the Articles of Confederation over the U.S. Constitution, but everyone's so rah-rah on the U.S. Constitution today, even those people who profess to love it and are really opposed to it, like Mr. Obama, that seems to be something that everyone's hung the moon on. But it was basically a compromise document, from everything having to do with slavery to states' rights and individual rights and the like. But the fact of the matter is that when the Constitutional Convention met in the 1780s to address the problems with the Articles of Confederation after the American Revolution, they were only empowered to just sort of tinker with and fix the Articles of Confederation. But what did those dirty dogs do? Well, they sequestered themselves, they locked the doors pretty much, and in a private session came up with a whole new document called the U.S. Constitution, and then shoved it down the throats of all the states to get them to ratify it. Of course, in doing so, they had to tack on the 10 amendments, you know, the right to free speech, the right to hold and bear guns, the right to freedom of religion, the right to not have British troops quartered in your private homes, and so forth and so on. And the moral to the story is that they went in just to fix something and they came out with a whole new document. Well, fast forward now from that time, 230 years almost later, and you come up with this effort to have a balanced budget amendment, and they're calling for a new constitutional convention. Well, if you're like me, you're hugely suspicious of what would happen today and what people would be doing and in this meeting. And quite honestly, the people I see pushing it on the so-called patriot side are all neocons. And you couldn't trust a neocon any further than you could throw them, because, I mean, George Bush is a neocon. The whole Bush family's neocons. All neocons are left-wing liberals who decided, well, kind of like the wolf put sheep's clothing on and got in amongst the sheep and wreaked havoc amongst the sheep. We can do the same thing. We'll just call ourselves conservatives, and we aren't really conservatives, but, you know, if we say the right mantras and say the right code words, we hate big government, we want taxes reduced, we think power should go back to the people, blah, blah, blah. If we say that, the people will be fooled. And lo and behold, of course, it works. George W. Bush got elected. His idiotic father got elected as well. You name it, they get elected. Well, these are the kind of morons who are behind the neocon-driven constitutional convention. And they've gotten a lot of states to agree to it. But fortunately, there have been some true patriots in the U.S. who are holding that back, because you can just imagine what they would come up with. They'd go into closed session. They'd come out with a brand new document. And I would bet you dollars to donuts, as they say in the States, that it will not resemble in the least the former U.S. Constitution. Oh, it may have a few special things, or like the Constitution of the Soviet Union, it may have certain protections written in there, but without the fundamental protections of a free market, private property, individual rights, it's going to be worthless. It's already tough enough. Yeah, and George Bush, Jimmy, you're absolutely right, said the Constitution is just a GD piece of paper. And the first time I heard that from him, not that I didn't know he was a fraud beforehand, it was enough to make me never like him ever again and know that there was no hope for him. The funny thing is, when I was 17 years old, I met George W. Bush in person. I didn't know that someday he'd become president of the United States. My father at the time, you'll all laugh, but, I was wanting to get into the Air Force Academy, and, I was 17, just barely 17. And he said, oh, well, you're congressman, you know, in the States to get into the academy, you have to be appointed by your congressman or congresswoman. So my congressman was, believe it or not, George H.W. Bush. And my father knew what church he was at. And we went to that Episcopalian church and went to meet him. But he wasn't there, but Barbara Bush was there and the boys were there. So I met Jeb Bush. I met George W. Bush. I met Barbara Bush and all of that. It's kind of funny, but throughout my life, I always seem to meet people like that. You know, it's funny, people that later rise to prominence, or maybe they already had, because that happened with me with Ludwig von Mises when I met him. Of course, he was already well famous by then. And Murray Rothbard, whom I met, and I was in his home, and I think I told you in another program about that story, but always seemed to be bumping into these characters right and left. Some are good characters and others aren't so terrific. But in any event, this is something to keep your eye on in the U.S. because they're going to try to find a way, the powers that be, are going to try to find a way to get rid of the Constitution. As toothless as the Constitution has become at this time, it is still technically the law of the land. And the powers that be have to pay lip service to it. They can't quite just trash it without revealing that they're the pirates that they really are. So it is something to really keep your eyes on. And if you see any news, send it my way, because I'm always interested in knowing what's going on and staying on top of some of these issues. And with everything going on, it's often pretty hard to do. Again, if anyone wants to call in, and you're tired of hearing me talk, and you want to tell me that, then dial country code 353, that's Ireland, and the phone number is 1-44-333-09. Now, why is it the British always say double four instead of 44 or 44 like the Americans and Canadians do? I don't know. There's something weird about that. I can't decide whether... I think if you're in the U.S., you have to think about it when a British person says that, because we aren't used to hearing it that way. And then, although being in Europe as often as I am, it, you know, I'm used to it now. But I remember the first time I had to think about it. What, double four? What's, oh, yeah, okay, that's 44. Anyway, do call. And if you don't, I understand too. Well, what else is in the news? You heard that Chavez, the erstwhile dictator president of Venezuela, died. Was it yesterday, day before yesterday? It didn't happen soon enough for me. I know some of you out there are huge fans of Chavez because he thumbed his nose at the U.S. Well, so did Adolf Hitler. So did Joseph Stalin. So is the idiot son dictator prince in North Korea. They thumb their noses at the U.S., but that doesn't mean they're good guys just because they're doing that. This guy was nothing but a two-bit dictator who took away the liberties of his people and ruined the economy of Venezuela. And the fact that he wasn't with the particular powers that be that run sort of the Anglophone world doesn't make it any better. It just means he was just a ridiculous, can I say on the program, horse's ass. And you know, any of these people who die like that are just helping the world. And, as Lucid says, just another dictator. I agree with that. And it's very clear that he's pretty much destroyed the Venezuelan economy, which was extremely strong before he came on. And in no small part, of course, due to the oil economy that it has and still has. And in fact, if it weren't for the oil wealth of that country, it really would have gone in the toilet a very, very long time ago. But Chavez spent so much time, energy, and money on the military and on starting his little civilian militia, basically sort of like the SA that Hitler started before he took control of Germany, that would go around beating the crap out of people and forcing them, just big bullies that went around and intimidated, if not outright beat into submission, those people who disagreed with Chavez and his program. Well, I don't know about you. Yeah, elected democratically four times. Well, you know what democracy is. I mean, democracy is basically a bunch of idiots voting. I mean, you think about it, and people put, well, first of all, you have to put in there that the democracy, the democratic election, and keep in mind what I was just telling you when someone on the chat line said he was democratically elected four times. He had his little SA army out there intimidating people. What does that tell you? How many people were intimidated away from the polls? I mean, they do that in the U.S. They do that in a number of countries, and that doesn't mean that it was a true democracy. Doesn't mean that he was really elected by the majority of people. And so what? Even if he was, BFD, who cares? Because all democracy is it's two wolves and a lamb deciding what to have for dinner. Is that fair? So if everyone on the chat room decides that we can vote and say Sven is to give us all his money, does that make it fair? Well, we all democratically voted. Sven got his chance to vote, so guess he lost out. Too bad for him. Now, the way it works in the real world, the way it should work in the real world, is that you have individual rights that are protected, and individual rights are not subject to democratic vote. You can't vote those away. We can't all, even if it's everyone in the universe but for Sven, we can't vote to take his money like that just because we decide we want it, we want to redistribute it. Well, that's what this moron was doing. That's what Chavez was doing. And he was basically redistributing the wealth. Now, some of these people, I'll grant you, didn't get their money in the best of ways. They had, prior to Chavez, they had their own little special interests, and they had their own little special ties to the Venezuelan government, and they worked the game the same way that Chavez did. But that doesn't mean that he could then, Chavez didn't limit himself to just taking wealth or redistributing wealth from those people. He did it from everyone that had money that wasn't on his side or wasn't playing his little game. So I'm sorry, democratically elected four times, probably in three of those four times it was due to fraud at the polls. So electoral fraud and voter fraud, people who had been dead for years voting at the polls. Some people voting multiple times, that's voter fraud. And electoral fraud is when it's distinct from and different from voter fraud. That's where they take the votes, no matter how fairly the votes were cast, and then they just reallocate the votes. That's electoral fraud. Like Stalin said, I don't care a whit for the right to vote. It's who gets to count the votes that really counts. And that's the way it is or and has been in Venezuela. So, you know, who wants a democracy, number one? And number two, being democratically elected means zip in my book and in most people's books who you know, have any brains. You just don't, you know, it just doesn't matter. It's not fair. There's too much voter fraud going on these days, too much electoral fraud, and especially if you have these, as they do in the States, these electronic voting machines where the programmers can just flip a switch, send a signal, and they can change what the voters are have actually decided. So, and yes, as Mahatma has correctly pointed out, Hitler was democratically elected. And did that make it right for him to assume power and start doing what he did? I think we all know the answer to that. Mussolini, same thing. So democracy, schmocracy, it's meaningless. I'm more a constitutional republic kind of guy where you have individual rights protected by a constitution and you have big, strong limitations on the power of the government and you diffuse power down to the local level as much as you can and just have the central government deal with the key issues and that's it. They don't deal with education. They don't deal with welfare. They don't deal with any of that. They just do national defense and national finances, maybe a nationwide court system, and that's it. And that is it. So anyway, have we beat the drum too much on that? You can tell my feelings on democracy, and it's just another form of mobocracy. Okay, well, I must be saying something right or something now not right because no one's called in. So where is everyone? All right. So speaking of which, let me see. The other things that we have coming up are we will probably this year, NHF will not go. I'm going to slip back to the Codex Alimentarius topic for a moment. We will not go to Canada because the GMO issue is no longer being addressed at that meeting, the food labeling meeting. We reached a compromise on that issue in a prior year, and the compromise just basically lets a country do whatever it wants to do on the labeling issue. But it doesn't require those countries like the U.S. and Canada to label if they don't want to. So being that as it may, we won't go to that meeting, but we will be continuing on with some of the nutrient reference values and some of the other issues that are going on at the nutrition committee and the like. So then let's go through some of the news now and see what we have. You know, in Switzerland, the voters approved limits on fat cat executive pay. Swiss voters approved some of the world's toughest limits on executives' pay in a referendum. And critics, of course, say that can make Switzerland less attractive to multinational corporations. But still, it's interesting because that movement seems to be more and more afoot on limiting these fat cat corporations from our executives from getting these huge in the millions of pounds or millions of dollars or euros, salaries and bonuses, which are very unfair when you compare them to the lower echelon salaries of the people who are there. They just will.
I've added a caller in there for you, Scott.
Okay. Who do we have on the line, Vin?
Hello.
Hi. You're on the air.
My name's Eamon. Any comments regarding Hugo Chavez?
Okay.
Do you have a reason?
Well,
you know, I took issue with the fact that you described him as a dictator, yet he was elected democratically four times. One of the elections of which was overseen by Jimmy Carter, one of your ex-presidents, he was very happy that the election was free and fair, and he received over 75% of the vote. So I think it's quite disingenuous of you to describe Chavez as a dictator. I also think it's disingenuous of you to describe him as a dictator in the same vein as Adolf Hitler. You mightn't agree with him. Keep a little bit of balance on it. That's all I'm saying to you.
Okay, I appreciate that. And did you have anything else to add to that?
Not particularly. I mean, it's the first time I tuned into TNS Radio. I expected that the people who would be presenting on the programs would actually be, let's say, unbiased and, let's say, consider what they're giving out as the news as distinct from personal opinion. And if it is just personal opinion, well, then, you know, maybe I should listen to a different show. So, I mean, maybe I'm just listening to the wrong show.
Who's right-wing? Excuse me?
Oh, this guy, Michael, I can't think of a second name. He's on the George Hook Show on News Talk. And I personally can't listen to him because I believe that he is just so absolutely, he's such a pro-Republican person. But then it's an alternative point of view that maybe a lot of people listen to, and that's their thing, not mine. I mean, the mainstream media this evening and last night on the BBC, on RTE, they described Chavez in the dictatorial type of person. He wasn't a dictator, whether we like it or not. He was democratically elected. And, you know, you have to respect democracy. Well,
I will respectfully disagree with you, and I'll tell you why. First of all, like I pointed out, just because even if he had been democratically elected after the first election, which I disagree with, though each and every election after that were ripe with fraud. And you pointed out that Jimmy Carter put his imprimatur on Chavez's election. Well, you know what? It's the same Jimmy Carter, Mr. Idiot Jimmy Carter, who put his seal of approval on Mugabe's election in Zimbabwe, Robert Mugabe, and Jimmy Carter's role as a monitor of free and fair elections, and he even has a center for that. Well, the low point of that came when he gave his blessings to Robert Mugabe's takeover in Zimbabwe, calling
we'll take Jimmy Carter. Listen, I wouldn't have a great respect for Jimmy Carter, but I thought he was, as an independent observer, he's only one of many. That being said, I traveled myself to Venezuela, and the people I met, the wealthy people I spoke to from Caracas, they were absolutely horrified with Chavez, horrified with him because of what he had taken from them. At the same time, you know, the 94% of the population in Venezuela now, 94% now are capable of having three meals a day. That wasn't the case 15 years ago. Less than half the people could eat or had enough to eat. You know, he has wrecked their economy in lots of ways. If we measure it by Western standards of economic progress, like Enda Kenny says, that, say, Ireland is doing very well. Ask 400,000 people on the dollar, after 200,000 like myself who emigrated.
I've got your point, and that's good enough. Now I'm going to respond, because it's very clear, and it's not just my opinion, that Chavez absolutely ruined the Venezuelan economy. And you talk about 94% of the Venezuelans being in favor of Chavez. That's just BS.
Okay, no problem at all, Scott. I appreciate you taking the time.
The problem is that we have a situation where Chavez, and I don't care if Jimmy Carter put his seal of approval on or not. Jimmy Carter's an idiot. He put his seal of approval on Stalin's elections. What you have are tons of Venezuelans thrilled that Chavez is gone. And if you look at the statistics, all those ones who were forced out of the country and had to flee the country, they are absolutely thrilled that he is gone. Some of them are wanting to go back and wanting to get back into the country. Some people are saying or have said, like, Venezuela will become a free country once again. I'm reading some of the reports right now. A jubilant celebration broke out in the Miami suburb of Doral late Tuesday after word spread of the death of the 58-year-old leftist. You know, you complained about right-wingers, but there can be two kinds of dictators, left-wing and right-wing. And if you think about what the political spectrum is, there's really not a left wing and a right wing. There's a libertarian and there's a totalitarian. You know, the political spectrum isn't a line going from left to right. It's really a circle. And if you look at it, just imagine it this way, visualize it this way. At the top of the circle is freedom, libertarianism. At the bottom is totalitarianism. You go to the right and you get people like Hitler. You go to the left, you get people like Stalin. They meet at the bottom. Those are the totalitarians. And then along the lines, either side, you go and you get up into social democracy and all those different things. So I'm sorry. I'm just not buying it that Chavez is any great hero. He thumbed his nose at the U.S. Yeah, that's good. That's probably the only good thing he did. But in terms of his own country, he left a horrible heritage. He devastated the country, and it's just good riddance to a bad dictator. Now, I think we lost our other caller. Can we get him back, Ben?
Johnny thought he was calling me about a different issue. Apologize for that, Scott. Well, I have to say, I agree with your breakdown of Chavez. You know, even if you are, inverted commas, democratically elected, it's how you conduct yourself when you're in office, in my opinion, that should determine what title you hold.
Exactly. Thank you. You said it better than I could have. You know, when he nationalized the oil industry there, it set a precedent and nationalized a lot of the other industry. He did a lot of harm to the economy. People think, oh, that's a great thing. Now, I don't mind that he took back assets from those who had stolen them in the first place. That's one thing. But there were legitimate there were legitimate private interests that had invested in that country that had not stolen wealth from Venezuelan people. Their assets were nationalized just equally as those country interests that were nationalized there. So this is all wrong, and it sets the whole environment for any country. If you do that, then where is rule of law? Where is protection for private property? No one can trust it. And then what happens? I don't care who it is, whether it's the grocery store chains or whether it's anyone who wants to do business in a country, they will not then want to take the risk with their own money to invest in that country again until the political atmosphere changes. So any way you look at it, Chavez did a lot of harm. And what he did to the country was really inexcusable for what he had. And he had his thugs running around intimidating people. Did people, even if people voted without electoral fraud there, how many were intimidated into voting the party line? I mean, just as it was in the Soviet Union before. So it's just absolutely not right, and it's good riddance. And I'm glad to be done with that guy. I just wish it could happen to a lot more of these Chavez and powers that be types, but who knows what will happen. So let's see. Well, I do appreciate the call in. Even though I disagreed with you, I appreciate your speaking up, and that was very nice of you. And please don't get the idea that I'm for the Republicans over the Democrats or the Democrats over the Republicans. I think they're just, as one person said long ago, that speaking in the U.S. mindset, mind you, that they're just two wings of the same bird of prey. It's really Party A and Party B, and there's really not much of a difference between the two of them. And that's the sad thing about American politics today. The other thing that's going on with the blessing of both parties is in Malibu, California, they're establishing one of four drone bases to start flying. Well, they have been flying, but to start flying in a more coordinated fashion, drones over the United States to monitor and to track American citizens. This is all part and parcel of Mr. Obama, who is a Chavez clone. He'd love to be like Chavez, and his own proposal was to create the same kind of militia citizenry that Chavez had done for the same reasons, to intimidate voters and the like. You know, at the last two presidential elections in the U.S., there were black thugs who were in black districts intimidating voters into voting only for Obama, you know, not voting for anyone else. And anyone who, especially a black person, who suggested that Obama should not be voted for, well, the extremists in the black community would just absolutely run roughshod over them. There was an actress, I forget her name, but she was in that movie Clueless with Alicia Silverstone, a black actress, and she came out publicly against Obama in the last general election in the U.S., and she was pilloried by all the blacks who were politically correct and the like. How could you do that? turn against one of your own. Well, those people were the biggest racists of all, just because, I mean, the voter turnout and the voter percent in the black districts in the U.S. during the last election were on the high side of what Stalin got during the Soviet elections. How could that possibly be? There were 97%+, 98%+ voter, black voters voting for Obama. And how did that happen? I mean, even in those districts, you wouldn't expect the turnout would be so lopsided. Were they so incredibly racist that they were just voting for Obama because of the color of his skin? Can't imagine that they would be, but so be it. So let's see. What else? The Bradley Manning, we know he is the guy who leaked secrets to on the WikiLeaks thing, leaked so-called national security secrets to...
Sorry for interrupting you there, Scott. There's another call on the line if you want to take them.
Oh, there is? Okay, let me see. Who is it? Let's take it rather than have to subject everyone to... Here's someone from the UK. Hello there. You're on the air.
Apparently they decided to hang up.
Okay. Well, I probably shouldn't have said they were from the UK. But at least they tried. They may have just lost the signal, and they're certainly welcome to call right back. So we're actually getting near the end of it. I can't believe that I just talked myself blue. I wanted to tell you, though, one thing to look for, and it's a very interesting topic, and I'd be very interested in your opinion, and I might even try to have this guy on the air, but it was an article that I read in Uncensored Magazine, the September 2012 issue, and the title of it, the lead article's title is "It Wasn't the Titanic." You might just Google that. By Vince, hey, another Vince there, Vince Lewis. And Vince Lewis's contention, as it has been for some others, is that the Titanic that sank 101 years ago, this coming April, that it was really the RMS Olympic. The RMS Olympic was evidently a huge albatross around the neck of the White Star Line, had already had several accidents. In fact, it had a collision with the HMS Hawk. About the year before and was declared scrap, basically, but at least privately, and it was the fault of the captain, Captain Smith, by the way, the same captain of the so-called Titanic that went down in April 1912. And Smith should have been cashiered, and the company, White Star Lines, was facing bankruptcy. But what did it do? It came up with a clever plan, and all the evidence around it seems to point to this being the truth, but I'd still be interested to know. Wait, here's someone back on again. Let's see. Is it? No. Okay. In any event, at the time that the Olympic was sailing, the Titanic was under construction, so they had to take the two propeller shafts, or at least one of the propeller shafts, I'm sorry, out of the Titanic in order to repair the Olympic and get it going again in the least amount of time. And they did that. And then what they probably did is, as Vince Lewis described it, is they switched the nameplates. Well, actually, the plates are engraved. The names are engraved on the back of the ship. But interestingly enough, on the Titanic, they put plates on it that said Titanic over the name, but it was really the Olympic underneath. And the other funny thing is they did this all almost overnight with changing some of the features of the Olympic and changed it to the name of the Titanic and then sailed it out to the middle of the Atlantic at a high rate of speed in a known iceberg zone with the attempt to try to sink it. And the captain was the same captain as the Olympic. Interestingly enough, J.P. Morgan, the owner of the White Star Line, he actually increased the insurance value of the RMS Titanic a few weeks before a maiden voyage. This was either a really super prudent move or he knew something no one else knew. Well, keep in mind that J.P. Morgan the day before he was supposed to board the Titanic for its maiden voyage across the Atlantic, he suddenly took ill, so to speak, and remained on shore instead, and it sailed away without him. Well, after it sailed away, people noticed him out in public and acting just very normally. He wasn't sick at all. And when the Olympic sailed under the name Titanic, as Vince Lewis proclaims, from Belfast, where it was launched, when it got to England or Wales, I forget which place, almost all of the boiler crew got off the ship and refused to work. And this was in spite of a big coal strike at the time. And so this is something I suggest people look into. I may try to have this guy or someone else who knows more about it on the show, if you'd like, to talk about it and make the case for this, because it's very curious. Because the Olympic, after it was damaged with its collision — it wasn't its first collision, by the way — it was they couldn't collect, the White Star Line couldn't collect on the insurance because it was their fault. It wasn't the HMS Hawk's fault. And so they knew they had a bad ship on their hands. And when the Titanic, and I say that with quote marks around it, sailed out for its maiden voyage across the Atlantic, it had a slight list to it, interestingly enough. And curiously enough, it had a different arrangement of portholes than it was having at the time it was in the dock being built and the shipyards being built. It had the kind of port numbering, the number of ports that the Olympic had. And now, many years later, 100 years later, where the name Titanic is riveted on in 4-foot-high letters, two of the letters, the A and the N, have fallen away down there in the Atlantic graveyard where the ship rests, where the wreck rests, and it reveals letters underneath. It reveals the letters M and the letters P etched into the steel underneath. And you can see this on videos that were taken by the deep sea divers. I'll leave you with those thoughts. Next week, we should have Red Alert radio interview that was done by Alex Gerrans of me. It'll be on next week because I'll be traveling. Thank you all for bearing with me. This was totally ad hoc, and most of you stood it up well. But stay tuned for Sean McGuire, and I will see you in a couple of weeks.